today on Against the Grain. Many landlords use sophisticated technology to surveil and screen tenants. I'm CS. The scholar, writer, and activist Aaron McElroy talks about what's called prop tech and its impact on renters and would-be tenants coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Facial recognition cameras, tenant screening platforms, digital property management and home surveillance tools, and AI-enabled building access control. Landlords today deploy a lot of technology. To what end? What impact does the use of so-called prop tech have on prospective renters, on tenants' lives and well-being, on their ability to respond to and organize against landlord abuse? Aaron McElroy has contributed an essay about landlord technologies to the volume Techno Creep and the Politics of Things Not Seen. Aaron is assistant professor of geography at the University of Washington and co-founder of the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project. They are also the author of Silicon Valley Imperialism, Techno-Fantasies and Frictions in Post-Socialist Times, which you'll hear about later this hour. When Aaron and I connected recently, I asked what a San Francisco-based friend of Aaron's had said about what their landlord had done.
The chapter begins with an anecdote about a friend of mine whose landlord, during the early days of the pandemic, installed a Google Nest camera outside of their door, right on their front porch, without my friend's consent, without the consent of any of the tenants who lived in the building. My friend was very concerned because this camera came replete with audio capture, and it was right next to their bedroom. My friend is an organizer and, you know, obviously doesn't want organizing work that they do to be caught on camera or through audio capture. And this was a moment in the early pandemic days in which we saw a proliferation of surveillance technology get rolled out, including in the space of the home, in San Francisco and many cities. In this case, Dish TV had made a deal with Google Nest to basically roll out this surveillance network for any property owner who chose to opt in. And the problem is that, you know, property owners choose to opt in, landlords choose to opt in, but tenants are not given any say as to what happens in their homes.
Yeah, and so this was a Google Nest facial recognition camera, as you said, complete with audio capture capacity. This was directed at the front entry, right? It just happened to be also near the window of your friend, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Technically, or legally, landlords can't install cameras like that in tenants' actual living quarters, but they can install them in front entrances, some in hallways if it's a multi-unit building, in garages, in laundry rooms, in those sorts of shared spaces. Not in somebody's bedroom or living room or kitchen per se, but, you know, the problem is, and for those who live in San Francisco know that, you know, so many of San Francisco windows are thin and rattly, and sound that might be generated inside might be captured if there's an audio capture right outside somebody's window. So that was partly what was so worrying. And also, you know, this camera would pick up any information about who came in and out of my friend's house. And, you know, tenants are never told where this data goes. They assume that their landlords have access to it, but people don't know, do the cops have access to it? These days, many tenants are worried, you know, does ICE have access to it? And tenants aren't given information about where this data goes. Like, what are the relationships in this case between Dish TV, Google, Alphabet, the police, the city, et cetera, et cetera? Like, where does this data get stored? Where does it transit? All of these are questions that tenants are rightfully worried about, but are never given information around. So it leads to tenants being very anxious, tenants oftentimes curbing or modifying their behavior and just the way they go about their day-to-day lives, because they're rightfully worried that data might be used against them. And there are many, many cases of, you know, really often petty lease violations being caught on camera and then being used to automate fines or even evictions. You know, for instance, if it says in one's lease that, you know, if you have a guest over for more than 3 days, you're supposed to register it with the landlord or something. And let's say a guest stays for 3.5 days and suddenly that's caught on camera and fed to the property manager, who then can just automate a fine or something like that. You know, there are stories of tenants accidentally putting recycling in the garbage or vice versa and that getting caught on camera and then a fine being generated. So, you know, all sorts of very, very minor, you know, lease violations suddenly become highly scrutinized. And so it leads to just contexts of tenants being very fearful of being surveilled all the time, as they are when these cameras get installed.
So what did you discover about the way Google Nest cameras, I guess, and other similar types of devices were marketed to property owners during various periods of time, including the uprisings for Black Lives?
Yeah, so as I note in the chapter, you know, this coincided with the uprising for Black Lives and of course, the first year of the pandemic. And what we've seen, you know, in various moments, for instance, even post 9/11, when discourses start to emerge that are often, you know, highly racialized and racist, in the case of the uprising for Black Lives, you know, landlords were fed information about dangerous people like roaming the streets or things like that. And, you know, so that if they install these cameras, they can protect their property from looters or whatever it might be. And of course, that's a very racist and problematic language, but it's one that Google Nest and Dish TV took advantage of. And in this case, you know, my friend told me that, you know, their landlord had never had anybody break into the building. That wasn't really a threat, but through this very, you know, strategically promulgated discourse of you know, dangerous people looting, the landlord kind of bought into the hype and then decided to install the camera.
So your chapter in this book, Techno Creep and the Politics of Things Not Seen, is entitled Undoing Landlord Technologies. So what else, what other systems and technology and devices are part of what you would call landlord technology, and I guess what is called in the industry prop tech?
The quote-unquote prop tech industry, that's what it is called in the real estate industry, that emerged post-2008 following the foreclosure crisis as a formalized subsect of the real estate industry. And prop tech, you know, is short for property technology. You know, following the financial crisis and the foreclosure crisis, we saw huge Wall Street investment companies like Blackstone and Invitation Homes gobble up, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of properties that had been foreclosed upon, you know, across the United States, but also globally. You know, Barcelona, for instance, was very hard hit by Blackstone as well. And so these huge investment companies needed new technologies to allow them to kind of scale property management or scale landlordism. And so kind of looking at fintech, which had transformed the finance industry, they were very eager for new digital, technical, virtual systems, basically, to automate different forms of property management and also automate kind of building acquisition, kind of all aspects of the real estate industry. And they coined this prop tech, but, you know, as I argue in the article and as many tenants have argued elsewhere, prop tech is an industry term. A lot of tenants don't understand or use the term prop tech in their day-to-day lives. And so beginning in 2019, I started this project called Landlord Tech Watch, and we started using landlord tech to basically better describe this technology and to kind of indicate who's in charge of it and to make it a little bit more understandable for tenants who might never have heard of prop tech, which really just gets used in real estate industry jargon. So we call it landlord tech, and we also have been arguing that, you know, it predates 2008, it predates the financial crisis, even though there was a huge proliferation then, you know, another moment of crisis, so to speak. But I often look back at the tenant screening industry as an early form of prop tech or landlord tech, which began in the 1970s. The first tenant screening company was called UD Registry, and it began in Southern California. And this is an industry that today 9 out of 10 landlords use. There are over 2,000 companies across the US. It's highly unregulated, so we don't know exactly how many companies get used. But long short, what it does is it amalgamates, you know, different data about tenants before they might move into a given unit. And it will today gather any prior eviction data or any data you might have in housing court about you. Even if a tenant has sued a landlord for being abusive, that could be used as a mark against them just because their name appears in housing court. So it gathers that data and it merges it with any sort of criminal record data and any sort of credit data. So basically, if you've been in the system, if you've been dealing with housing precarity, anything like that, if you're poor, that gets used against you. And so the tenant screening industry very much reproduces cycles of housing precarity and carcerality. So there's a lot to be critical of in terms of how it works. But yeah, like I said, it actually emerged in the 70s, and it emerged after, you know, certain civil rights era legislation was passed, like the Fair Housing Act, and certain consumer rights protections were also passed, you know, in the late 60s. And so it became technically illegal for landlords to discriminate against tenants based on race, for instance. But landlords realized that if they could use data that was apparently race neutral, they could continue to kind of gatekeep who they admit into their buildings. And so that's sort of how and why, you know, the tenant screening industry emerged. And as we know, the data itself is highly racially coded. So the kind of racist systems that, you know, the Fair Housing Act was created to protect tenants from are still, manifesting in the space of housing, but through the sort of algorithmically coded industry that we call tenant screening.
My guest is Erin McElroy. They are assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Washington, where they run the Anti-Eviction Lab. And we are talking about a chapter Erin contributed with the title Undoing Landlord Technologies to the volume Techno Creep and the Politics of Things Not Seen. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What relationship do you see between the development of tenant screening practices and the development of computing technology in Silicon Valley?
There's an interesting entangled evolution that the two have been a part of for decades now. Tenant screening as a formal industry began in 1974, you know, during the Cold War, during a moment that Silicon Valley itself was just emerging as the place called Silicon Valley and, you know, the Stanford Research Park. But, computing was, of course, very rudimentary then. And the tenant screening industry was really just using one data set. It was only using eviction data. But with time, as computing became more sophisticated and as the industry began to see particular courts begin to digitize their records, the tenant screening industry kind of emerged alongside, you know, advances in computing and alongside advances in digitization and database construction. And so by the dot-com boom, by the late 90s and early 2000s, there had been some pretty big strides in terms of courts and different, data keepers digitizing what had just been analog records. And that very much coincided with 9/11 and the war on terror that followed. And so there are pretty extreme examples of, you know, particular tenant screening companies being relatively small pre 9/11 and then doubling, tripling, you know, quadrupling in size after, under the auspices of assisting landlords in keeping quote unquote terrorists out of their buildings. You know, but we saw this too, of course, in terms of policing and in terms of just carceral systems more generally in our cities, but that definitely held true in the space of housing, particularly regarding the tenant screening industry.
Yeah, and in fact, you spend some of this chapter in this book talking about how surveillance platforms and other forms of prop tech or landlord technology extend the carceral state into domestic space. Elaborate on that.
I mean, a lot of that maps onto what prison abolitionists have long been arguing about, what gets termed the prison industrial complex, which is a framework that understands that carceral systems are not restricted to prisons, not restricted to what police might do themselves, but seep into sometimes like everyday life in terms of how you know, people are being policed. And that holds true in the space of housing, so that, you know, even if there are not, you know, police or ICE agents perhaps in one's home, you know, watching everything that one might do, just the sheer fact that there may be camera systems gathering that information extends carcerality into domestic space and very much impacts how people go about living their day-to-day lives. And, you know, the home is supposed to be a space of refuge from so much of the violence in the world, but when that violence can seep into the home through different recording devices, that very much changes one's relationship to spaces of home and refuge and safety.
Yeah, and then the ever-present background of the system of capitalism is important to you, and the way in which landlord tech, I'm reading here, aims to reproduce capitalist stability, especially amid crises. You deploy the term racial techno-capitalism. How would you define that?
A lot of this research has been critical of both techno-capitalism and racial capitalism. And in many ways, I would definitely argue that capitalism has always been a form of racial capitalism. By adding racial to the beginning of it, we're signaling how racialism and raciality have long been, since the emergence of capitalism, a determining factor in terms of how capitalist operations work, how cycles of primitive accumulation and dispossession work. You know, scholars such as Cedric Robinson, but even before him, many scholars have been making the point that the transition from feudalism into capitalism reproduced particular racial regimes that were already present in feudalism. And so I'm invested in those histories and how they play out, particularly in the domain of property. And I think, you know, we can see property itself as a technology of racial capitalism. I mean, whether we're looking at land that's been stolen and commodified, or we're looking at how, you know, particular people through histories of racial capitalism have been rendered property, there's a lot to critique about property itself. And so, you know, many abolitionists will argue that abolition is only possible if we free ourselves from the construct of property altogether. But, you know, at the same time, there are those who have made the point that capitalism has continued to evolve through different technological advances over the centuries. And so in that sense, we could see capitalism as always implicated in various technological evolutions. This is, you know, whether we're looking at, you know, Marx's writings when he was critiquing particular advances in industrialization, or, you know, whether we're looking at what's happening today, the two technological advances and capital development often goes hand in hand. So, yeah, so by kind of merging or bridging these frameworks together, I come up with the framework of racial techno-capitalism in order to really get at this nexus, which I see very much playing out in the space of landlord tech, and that ultimately, at the end of the day, a technology that's used to allow landlords to capitalize upon property to, in some cases, evict tenants, raise rents, accumulate more capital for a particular property that's owned. And at the same time, they're using technology in order to do this and reproducing contexts of racial banishment and dispossession.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Aaron McElroy joins me. They teach geography at the University of Washington. Aaron co-founded the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project and wrote the book Silicon Valley Imperialism, Techno-Fantasies and Frictions in Post-Socialist Times. I will want to ask Aaron about that book a bit later on. And they contributed a chapter about landlord technologies to the new volume Techno Creep and the Politics of Things Not Seen, edited by Neda Hatanasaski and Nassim Parvin. So you have all these, you have many landlords doing a lot of things to tenants, and you have tenants who get upset, and then you have tenants who try and figure out who their landlord is. And this may not have been an issue in, you know, decades past, where it was pretty clear who your landlord was. It was a typically, I thought, a person who you could identify, whose name was on the lease. But you point to the corporate use of shell companies to buy buildings. Talk about this practice and what it does to tenants' ability to even know who their landlord is.
So it was really that moment that that I mentioned that saw the birth of the prop tech industry formalized, the post-2008, post-foreclosure moment, when these huge investment companies like Blackstone bought up all of these racially foreclosed homes across the U.S. and beyond. But what we saw in terms of Blackstone's practices and in terms of the practices of other large investment companies, like Invitation Homes and Trinity, some of the big ones at the time, was that they were using shell companies, so limited liability companies or limited partnerships, in order to purchase these properties and administer them. And, perhaps this was just what was, easy for them in terms of a corporate business model. It also allowed them particular tax benefits, incorporation benefits, and all of the things that shell companies provide. But it also rendered a particular level of anonymity for them so that, it's not that a tenant would be like, oh, my landlord is Blackstone. It might be some, obtuse sounding shell company with a bunch of letters and numbers in it. And indeed, many, many tenants living in these homes that became often single family rentals across the country were paying rent to some shell company of a shell company of a shell company. And soon after, in cities like San Francisco, where there might be, less single-family homes and more multi-building apartments, we began to see other real estate speculators sort of copy this model of using shell companies to purchase buildings. And I became aware of this when I was a housing organizer in San Francisco, the kind of, 2012, 2013 moment. I was part of a group called Eviction Free San Francisco. And we would support tenants who were being evicted in order to fight back. We had a mutual aid model. And so if tenants were being evicted or thought they might be evicted soon, they could come to one of our meetings and we would work with them to organize a campaign to stop their eviction. But increasingly tenants would show up to our organizing meetings and not know who was actually evicting them and would just know some random shell company was evicting them. There was a case of this one elderly woman who was 97 at the time. Her name was Mary Elizabeth Phillips, and she was being evicted by a shell company called 55 Dolores Street LLC. And she had been paying rent to a human landlord for decades. That human landlord sold the building to 55 Dolores Street LLC, and then they promptly issued her an eviction notice. And their goal was to evict everybody in the building and then sell these rent-controlled units off as condos and profit. But Mary and her neighbors couldn't figure out how to protest if they couldn't figure out like who was even evicting them, because one of the tactics we would often use would be showing up to the offices of landlords and, you know, demonstrating outside of the offices. But again, there was no office for 55 Dolores Street LLC. And so through a bunch of research, we began to kind of stitch different data sets together ourselves. And we found that 55 Dolores Street LLC was the subsidiary of a bigger investment company called Urban Green, which did have headquarters in San Francisco in Pacific Heights. And then we found that they themselves were a subsidiary of yet a bigger company called Cornerstone Holdings, based in Colorado. And that research was not easy to do. And we realized that we needed to do much more of that research in order to keep up with the eviction crisis. And so that was that need for information around who the actual humans are behind shell companies and, you know, what are their property portfolios across the city or across the country. That sort of question animated the formation of a project that I helped start back in 2013 called the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, which today it continues to be a collective. We have a chapter in the Bay Area, also in LA and New York, and we have a new chapter now in Seattle. But one of the ongoing tasks of the collective is to do this research on property ownership so that tenants can better understand who their landlords actually are, so that they can, whether it means forming a tenants union or forming a multi-building coalition across all the buildings that a landlord might own, tenants can build tenant power and, you know, fight back against harassment and abuse and of course, evictions. But I suppose the irony is, though, that, you know, these companies know so much about tenants through tenant screening, through the different surveillance technologies that they impose, and tenants have to do a ton of work to even know the name of their landlord half the time. So the data ecosystem is very uneven, and so some of what we've been doing in the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project is trying to, I guess, make it a little bit more even by providing tools and resources for tenants who are trying to figure out who their landlords are and what other buildings they own and, you know, have they evicted in their other buildings and questions like that.
Yeah, and you are interested in tenant struggles, tenant organizing. Tell us what happened in 2018 in Brooklyn. The owner of a large rent-stabilized apartment building in Brooklyn installed a heat mapping facial recognition platform. How was the introduction of this platform justified, and how did tenants respond?
It was in 2018 that this property owner, Robert Nelson, who owns multiple buildings in New York City, decided to implement this facial recognition system that used cutting-edge heat mapping technology, apparently, that could allegedly detect if somebody could verify somebody's identity based on a heat scan of their face. And Robert Nelson wanted to implement this in one of the low-income buildings that he owned in Brooklyn, in Brownsville. It's basically two buildings. It's a complex called Atlantic Plaza Towers, but, you know, with 718 units and, many, many tenants, most of whom are not white, and many of whom have lived in the building for generations. And tenants were very disturbed when they found out that he wanted to install this, in part because some of the tenants already knew that facial recognition software has been proven to reproduce racial bias. It's much better at recognizing white cis male faces than it is of Black women's faces. And tenants decided to fight back. And luckily, they already had a strong tenant association in the building that they were able to mobilize. A couple of the floor captains became, really powerful leaders. Two in particular, Trine Moran and Fabian Rogers, are tenant organizers who I got to know and work alongside. And they ultimately were successful in fighting back, but they faced a lot of repression along the way. For instance, as they were trying to distribute information to other tenants in their building about the harms associated with facial recognition, existing CCTV cameras that had already been installed in the building captured footage of them organizing. And then the landlord or the property manager made these like paper printouts of the photos of them organizing in the lobby and then slid those printouts under their doors as an intimidation tactic. And so they faced all sorts of obstacles, but they built really strong alliances with researchers, with lawyers, with other tenants and tenant organizations. And at the end of the day, Nelson decided it wasn't worth it to install this heat mapping technology. So it was a win. And I had just moved to Brooklyn when this was happening. And so getting to work with them led to the formation of Landlord Tech Watch, which emerged as a collaborative project that involved some of the tenants at Atlantic Plaza Towers, which then went on to form a, they went on to form a new organization called the Ocean Hill-Brownsville Alliance to educate other tenants in the neighborhood about the harms of facial recognition technology and landlord tech. At the time, it also involved a research institute called the AI Now Institute. It also involved the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project. And today is housed in the Anti-Eviction Lab, which I run at the University of Washington. But yeah, what we do is aim to produce popular educational materials and public scholarship and different toolkits that tenants can use to understand the harms of landlord technology and to strategize ways to fight back against its deployment.
That's the voice of Erin McElroy. We have a link to their faculty page in the Department of Geography at the University of Washington on our website, againstthegrain.org. Erin contributed a chapter with the title Undoing Landlord Technologies Beyond the Propertied Logics of the Pandemic Past and Present to the volume Technocreep and the Politics of Things Not Seen. Erin is also author of Silicon Valley Imperialism. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Fair to say, Erin, that you consider yourself an abolitionist in relation to a lot of things, but also in relation to landlord tech? And if so, what would such an approach to landlord technology, to prop tech, look like?
Yeah, do you consider myself an abolitionist? Absolutely. In terms of prop tech and landlord tech, I mean, there are a number of things. I would say for one, and this holds true across a lot of abolitionist organizing beyond the fights against prop tech, but, you know, we often see, you know, reform as not good enough. And, you know, while reform might be a strategy or a tactic, the abolitionist horizon in the case of prop tech would be a horizon in which property doesn't exist, in which landlord technologies don't exist, in which we abolish these systems that reproduce racial and carceral capitalism. You know, there have been a number of attempts to reform landlord tech or prop tech or, you know, facial recognition systems more broadly. To make them fairer, to make them more accountable, to make them transparent. Those are some of the buzzwords in some of these sort of like AI ethics spaces. And what we often see in those spaces, you know, is a recognition that, again, for instance, with facial recognition, it does reproduce racial bias in part because the training models that it uses have been disproportionately trained on white cis male faces. So one of the solutions then becomes, okay, what if we insert more diversity into the training data? Can we make facial recognition less racist or less sexist or something like that? And
right, and just to say, if the camera doesn't recognize a certain kind of face, then they are more likely to be excluded from the building. Is that right?
They could be excluded. Sometimes they could be overmatched with somebody else, and so somebody who might apparently be recognized as them could be let into the building instead. You know, it could lead to over arresting, and we've seen that in multiple spaces with facial recognition. You know, somebody gets interpreted as somebody else because the model is not good. And that reproduces often anti-Black racism in particular. But so what we're seeing in the sort of reformist space would be like, okay, let's make the tech less racist. But ultimately, the goal would be, in that case, to keep the technology. But an abolitionist approach would be one in which we want to abolish the technology altogether and see no reason why there should be, cameras deployed in one's home, even if it's a less racist camera or using a less racist algorithm. We're still committed to abolishing these carceral systems because, you know, at the end of the day, they're still gathering data about people. They're still, you know, feeding data to the police. They're still transmitting a sort of carceral system into the space of one's home and impacting how people go about their day-to-day lives. And I mentioned earlier too, I mean, if we wanted to take a few steps back, we could see property itself as a construct that's, you know, emerged through a kind of a longer history of racial capitalism, one that is very much tied up in carceral landscapes and geographies. And so I think there, an abolitionist call in the realm of prop tech or landlord tech would also be one in which we want to abolish, you know, property as a construct, which isn't going to happen overnight, but is on the horizon of possibility and on the horizon of our organizing strategies more broadly.
Aaron McElroy, your book, Silicon Valley Imperialism, Techno-Fantasies and Frictions in Post-Socialist Times, was published recently. What do you mean by Silicon Valley imperialism?
Many things. Silicon Valley imperialism is a construct that I use to kind of think through both the local and global geographies of Silicon Valley in different ways. Silicon Valley, you know, itself emerged as one of many layers of colonial imperial violence in California in the 70s during the Cold War on unceded indigenous lands. And so there are different ways to kind of look at the violence of Silicon Valley as a space. Also, it being a sort of fictional space in that, you know, there actually is not a place called Silicon Valley on the map, so to speak. It's an aspiration that, many spaces in the South Bay, but now I would argue San Francisco too, used to kind of espouse a sort of fantasy of technological prowess and becoming. But in the book, I also look at aspirations of becoming Silicon Valley as they grow outside of California, outside of the US even. And so a lot of the book takes place actually in Romania, in a place that has been dubbed the Silicon Valley of Eastern Europe. And of course, there are many places around the world and even throughout the US that are now these silicon spaces. So like the Silicon Valley of India and Bangalore or, you know, Silicon Plateau, or, you know, there are all these silicon fantasies. And so in the book, I look at what does it mean for a space to, quote unquote, become siliconized, but also, what are the different material violences that take place as those transformations occur. And so, I look at Silicon Valley imperialism as, you know, something that exists within the realm of fantasy, that also exists as a form of epistemic violence and that it erases other histories of place and space, but also as a process that often incites racial dispossession and expulsion as spaces become whiter and wealthier and more recognizable as Silicon Valley, even if it remains a fantasy.
Yeah, and I guess what you just said is part of what you would call siliconization, right? The racial dispossession included, and that makes me think of Romania and what racial groups we're talking about in terms of people who might have been pushed out and may continue to be pushed out of spaces where high-tech companies and workers want to locate.
In cities like Cluj and Bucharest, which are the two cities I've lived in and spent the most time in Romania, racial expulsion often means pushing Roma people, Roma communities outside of city centers or kind of into these interstitial wastelands squeezed between the rural and the urban that have been kind of made a catchment for those that the city wants to oust as it siliconizes. And there's a really long history of anti-Roma racism in Romania, across Eastern Europe, across Europe more broadly. So this kind of new wave of siliconization is one that kind of triggers a much longer history of anti-Roma racism. Yeah, for those who don't know, Roma people were enslaved in Romania for hundreds of years, and emancipation took place relatively around the same time that it did in the U.S. And similarly, there were, you know, promises of reparations that were failed promises. And this isn't to say that the stories are totally parallel, but just for those who might want some kind of familiar reference points. Roma people were made, alongside Jewish people, were made the subjects of racial extermination regimes during the fascist period in Romania, which ended right when the state socialist period began, so kind of like World War II era. And with state socialism, although it was far from perfect, it was the first time that the state provided resources like housing and education, healthcare, things like that, to Roma people who had been, very much targeted and denied provisions prior. And so during socialism, a lot of folks were able to finally get homes and establish communities in the city center. And then when state socialism ended in 1989, there was this big kind of imperative across Romania, across Eastern Europe, to disavow the socialist period, to disavow any sort of socialist economic policy, and to embrace capitalism. And, you know, that was the vehicle for the, you know, becoming part of the EU and becoming, you know, part of NATO and these things that took place in the early 2000s. And so that meant reprivatizing property that had basically been made public housing throughout the socialist period. And so there are a series of acts that are called property restitution acts or property restitution laws, but basically property reprivatization laws that have been implemented in Romania, which basically return housing that had been made national or public to pre-socialist property owners. And so this has meant that many Roma people who are living in public housing or who have been living in public housing are targeted for eviction as property is reprivatized. But promises of siliconization have very much sped up that process. And so in the book, I look at how these different kind of histories and these different promises of Europeanization, Westernization, siliconization, all impel evictions and new forms of racial banishment. In the case of Romania, this has also been the reason why housing justice groups have been organizing over the last decade, because of this sort of very racialized eviction crisis that we can see in cities like Bucharest and Cluj and Timișoara.
Techno-fascism is a word and analytic used to describe the current conjuncture. Some of the histories you've been talking about and that are included in this book, Silicon Valley Imperialism, by my guest Aaron McElroy, do they document a kind of development or emergence of techno-fascism?
Yeah, so I think a lot about techno-fascism in the book, and of course the book was written before the current Trump 2.0 presidency, and a lot of the and it was also written before October 7th and the kind of contemporary wave of genocide in Gaza. But there are different, you know, moments today that a lot of people are using to think through techno-fascism with, that I'm interested in kind of seeing as a contemporary layer of a longer process. And so in my book, I look at particular moments, including during the fascist period in the 20s and 30s in Romania, in which, technology was used to orchestrate fascistic practices. And so That also very much had to do with U.S. tech companies. And so I've been interested in kind of thinking about, for instance, companies like Palantir or even Microsoft and Google and all of the tech companies that are being used today as kind of that contemporary layer of this longer history of U.S. and Silicon Valley, you know, companies being part of fascistic and genocidal orchestrations. But in the case of Romania, it was actually in, I found this in the archives actually by accident, but in the late 30s, IBM calculators, so this is before there were actually computers, but these are kind of pre-computer calculators, were being shipped from the US to Romania to be used by the fascist government in order to map where Roma people lived, Jewish people, sex workers, anybody that might be labeled degenerate, as the language was used at that time. And those machines were used in Romania's 1941 census. And also IBM was providing these tabulators that were used to orchestrate trains that were sending people to concentration camps. And what's interesting is that, well, in the book, I talk, there's an anecdote about in 2011 or 2012 in San Francisco, actually, there was this famous Jeopardy game where IBM's supercomputer AI Watson won Jeopardy. And it was this kind of moment that marked advancements in digital technology. And everybody was so interested that this computer beat the other two players in Jeopardy. And the irony is that it beat those two players when a question was asked about the author of Dracula, who was Bram Stoker. And Bram Stoker wrote Dracula very much using kind of Orientalist and Gothic stereotypes about Romania very long ago. But Stoker had never actually been to Romania. He was just kind of employing all of these tropes about, you know, vampires and things like that. But ironically, you know, Thomas Watson, who was the founder of IBM, spent a lot of time in Romania and knew the fascist leader, Antonescu. He also was spending time in Nazi Germany and knew Hitler, and was working with these guys and bringing his computers to Romania. And then as soon as state socialism began, IBM left. Interestingly, they then went to Palestine, and they also went to South Africa after that. They have a whole history of going to these various places of imperial violence and fascistic violence and helping various governments with their projects. Anyway, fast forward to 1989, state socialism ends. IBM comes rushing back into Romania, basically to extract workers and resources and to advance their sort of new outsourcing future. So anyway, so I kind of look at this broader trajectory of IBM in the book. And I think today, you know, a lot of people see these companies as liberal, as, you know, doing the work of advancing knowledge through computing. But I think it's really important to understand and to reckon with their fascist pasts, which are very much being used to orchestrate, you know, fascist violence in the present. So I look at a similar story with IKEA, but there are a bunch of these companies that we don't necessarily think of as having roots in actual fascist regimes, but that very much do, and that continue to sort of capitalize upon resources and contexts of war and genocide today in different ways.
I understand the original title of the book, Silicon Valley Imperialism, was Unbecoming Silicon Valley. What did you mean by Unbecoming Silicon Valley?
As much as I look at these processes of becoming siliconized or becoming Silicon Valley, even if they remain aspirational projects, in the book, I'm also very much invested in looking at ways that people refute those projects and processes. And, you know, a lot of this book was written in a time when I was very much immersed in different housing justice movements, both in San Francisco and in Bucharest and Cluj and Romania, where the daily acts of organizing against evictions and dispossession was also an act of refusing siliconization. and the sort of racial geographies it was attempting and continues to attempt to impart. But also in the book, I'm very much interested in other histories of computing and technological development that take place outside of the auspices of Silicon Valley. There's a lot in the book about different histories of kind of hacking and DIY computer making in Romania that, you know, a lot of youth and, you know, just kind of people living their day-to-day lives were a part of, in part because they couldn't afford to buy fancy computers. This is kind of in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of technological knowledge was kind of developed in these subversive spaces. And so I've been invested in thinking through those histories alongside, just different work that artists and a lot of cultural makers have engaged with in Romania, imagining other techno futures, antithetical to Silicon Valley. And then just, the day-to-day work of housing organizing and anti-gentrification organizing. And also just recognizing that neither Cluj, Romania, which is apparently the Silicon Valley of Eastern Europe, or Palo Alto or a place in the South Bay, those places are not Silicon Valley either. They're, in the case of the South Bay, Ohlone lands that are unceded, and in the case of Romania, they are not, it's not Silicon Valley. So I think just recognizing these spaces have their own histories that that continue to live despite the imposition of these frameworks like siliconization. I think the recognition of those other realities is very important.
Erin McElroy, assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Washington, where they run the Anti-Eviction Lab, co-founder of the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, author of Silicon Valley Imperialism, and we've talked also about a chapter Erin contributed to the volume Techno Creep and the Politics of Things Not Seen, Erin's article having the title Undoing Landlord Technologies. Erin, thank you for your work and for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me and for this really fun conversation. I appreciate it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.